If you turn over to Matthew chapter 23, we'll get started where we left off last week. Let me just say, make one more comment. This is kind of heavy on my mind, this family. Dad, Ken, texted me this afternoon. I was studying, and she just took a turn for the worse today. Nobody was expecting her to pass. She was in critical care. But anyway, and asked me to come up there. This couple, I've been 25 years, upwards around 600 funerals over those 25 years, and I don't know that I've ever seen a couple have so much peace and handle the loss of their daughter in a more graceful, godly way. Now, I don't know that there's a wrong way to handle it. Don't misunderstand me, but they were just so at peace. And that's an impact. That's something I don't know anything about. I've never lost a child, but it's just such a godly example. And all week long, as I visited with them, their testimony of what serving the Lord, and then to see then when this happens, just the three of us in there with her in that room, and they were just. It was just a piece that was just, I've never seen it before to that degree. It's a blessing to me. It really was. So here we go. Matthew chapter 23. We'll begin in verse 16. It says, "Woe unto you, ye blind guides, which say, whosoever shall swear by the temple, it is nothing. But whosoever shall swear by the gold in the temple, he is a debtor. Ye fools and blind, for whether is greater, the gold or the temple that sanctifieth the gold? And whosoever shall swear by the altar, it is nothing. But whosoever sweareth by the gift that is upon it, he is guilty. Ye fools and blind, for whether is greater, the gift or the altar that sanctifieth the gift? Whosoever therefore shall swear by the altar sweareth by it, and by all things thereon. And whosoever swear by the temple sweareth by it, and by him that dwelleth therein. And he that shall swear by heaven sweareth by the throne of God and by him that sitteth thereon." Now let me tell you, that's a mouthful, okay? And when I started studying and preparing, I knew that, I thought, man, this is confusing to me. How am I going to explain it in such a way that everybody can grasp it? But actually, it was much easier than I thought when I began to go over it and read the smart guys. And so, first of all, he starts off by calling the scribes and the Pharisees blind guides. That's the first thing he says there in verse 16. Now, all the other indictments previous to this, he just simply called them hypocrites. But now he called them blind guides in this next text. And he's just simply, that's an emphasis on the fact that they didn't know the truth themselves, but yet they put themselves in positions of teaching all the other Jewish people about the things of God. And so there were blind guides. Jesus had applied this title to them earlier in this book. In Matthew chapter 15, verse 14, he says, "They be blind leaders of the blind, and if the blind lead the blind, both shall fall into the ditch." And so that's what he's talking about. The scribes and the Pharisees prided themselves in having all this spiritual knowledge, and they were the leaders of the spiritually blind nation of Israel, and they were showing them the way. And Jesus says, it's just like a blind man leading a blind man. You're doomed for judgment yourselves. And so after titling them blind guides, he brings another indictment beginning in verse 16 and on through the remainder of those verses. And again, I'll try to explain. It's kind of hard to understand, but then when you get right to it, it's not that complicated. Verse 16 again, he says, "Ye blind guides, which say, whosoever shall swear by the temple, it is nothing, but whosoever sweareth by the golden temple, he is a debtor." Now, among all the many traditions that the scribes and the Pharisees had added to God's word all over the course of previous centuries, which were in the thousands, okay, among all of those traditions was the practice of verifying statements or agreements by swearing by an object. In other words, like they would say, "I swear on the temple, this is true," this sort of thing. And it was their way of sealing or guaranteeing a promise or a contract. It was kind of akin, it's not apples to apples, but kind of akin to our practice of swearing in a president or swearing a witness in a witness in a court of law by laying their hand upon the Bible when they take that oath to tell the truth or to do the truth or do what's right. It's akin to that, but like all man-made traditions do, or often do, the practice that they had led to more complications and the twisting and the perverting of the way God wanted it to be, okay? And so as absurd as it may sound, they had developed a very ridiculous set of rules about specific things that could be swore by, okay? And we see examples of this in chapter 16 through 22, the verses we read. And by the way, we're not going to cover every single verse because the principle that it explains it, and then we'll go on to something else. But Jesus is declaring to them how foolish they are by swearing by one thing and saying if you swear by that, it won't work. It's not binding. You swear by something else, and it is binding. And these ridiculous rules. And so, if a person made a promise or a commitment, according to verse 16, a promise or a commitment that was bound by the temple, they swore by the temple, then it says that's not a legitimate binding agreement by law. Notice what he says there. He says, whosoever shall swear by the temple, it is nothing. In other words, it's not valid. It's of no use if you swear by the temple. But then it was legal and binding if they swore by the gold of the temple. One of their rules was you swear by the gold of the temple, and in a court of law, it'll hold up. In Jewish law, it's good. And he says there in the end of verse 16, saying he is a debtor. If he swore by the gold of the temple, he's accountable. He owes that debt or to pay that penalty or whatever the case is. And so he goes on in verse 18 and gives another example. If a person swore by the altar, it is nothing. In other words, not binding, no good. But if you swore by the gift that's upon the altar, which really a reference to the sacrifice that had been made on the altar, then that's okay. That's legally binding. And so if you fail to follow through with that oath or that commitment made over the sacrifice of the altar, then according to law, you're going to be held accountable. And it sounds ridiculous, doesn't it? But when you read it, that's exactly what Jesus is saying. This is how their traditions and laws had what it had evolved in. And so these seven verses are a record of Jesus just laying that out in detail, what these blind leaders were doing and what they had resorted to. Had they not been so caught up in devising all these little technicalities in the law, all these little just junk, they could have just enjoyed the way God made it, where you give somebody your word, and then that's your contract, your word is your bond sort of thing. They could have let their word be enough to bind any commitment or any agreement. There's a verse in Deuteronomy chapter 23. I forgot to tell y'all to put it on the screen, but let me read it to you. Deuteronomy 23:23 says this, which obviously Deuteronomy, Old Testament law, the Jews should have known this, okay? It says, "That which is gone out of thy lips thou shalt keep and perform, even a free will offering, according as thou hast vowed unto the Lord thy God, which thou hast promised with thy mouth." What's he saying there? He says, when you say something is going to be done, you do it. You say something, you're not going to do something, then you don't do it. And he says, even a free will offering. And what he's doing there is giving an example, saying a free will offering was a voluntary offering, okay? It wasn't a requirement. It was nothing in the law said you had to give this free. A free will offering was saying, hey, I just want to be generous and give this offering. He's saying even that If you make that verbal commitment, you better follow through with it. In spite of the fact that it's not like a tithe that's required of you, you said that you vowed that you were going to do it, then do it. And so that's what that verse is saying. Even something that's voluntary, if you say you're going to do it, then you're committed to doing it. And that's the way God meant for it to be, which is that way today. I know even you can sign 9 times on the dotted line today, and it's still, you know, they'll beat you out of it somehow. It's just the way our society is. But God made it simple. Jesus declared this very same truth back in the Sermon on the Mount when he said this. He says, "But I say unto you, swear not at all, neither by heaven, for it is God's throne, nor by earth, for it is his footstool, neither by Jerusalem, for it is the city of the great king, neither shalt thou swear by the head, because thou canst not make one hair white or black." Watch this. "But let your communication be yea, yea, nay, nay, for whatsoever is more of this cometh of evil." So Jesus, he nailed it back there in the Sermon on the Mount. He says, say yes, that means yes. Say no, that means no. That ought to be it. All this swearing by these different things was a man-made deal. So sadly, that was what it had come to, and that's what Jesus is indicting them for in this particular text. And I hope that it's understandable to you. It scared me when I started the study, but it come together pretty good. It makes sense. So anyway, we'll move on. And to verse 23, he goes on one more time. He says, "Woe unto you, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites." So he's back to that characterization of them. He says, "For ye pay tithe and mint and anise." You pay tithe of mint, anise, and cumin, and have omitted the weightier matters of the law, like judgment, mercy, and faith. These ought to have been done, and not to leave the other undone. Ye blind guides, which strain at a gnat and swallow a camel. This particular indictment, Jesus, what he's pointing out here is how they were very good at magnifying trivial things and then minimizing some of the very important essential things, and they were notorious for this. Mint, anise, and cumin were just simple garden herbs that people used for kitchen spices. They used it for their cooking and this sort of thing. They were not considered farm produce. They were just small things that were used for the kitchen at home. Okay, whereas a person may have a crop of wheat or corn or barley that's farm production. That's something that's raised to support their livelihood. Okay, and those things like the wheat and all that, the farm production would be tithed on. It would be necessary to tithe, like you and I are tithing on our paycheck. That was their paycheck. And so God expected them to tithe on that. Even fruits, vegetables, grapes, olives, figs, these sort of things were produce for the purpose of sustaining a family, either to be sold or to be bartered with. They were basically crops to be harvested and maintain the family. And of course, those things, according to Scripture, were to be tithed on. But these self-righteous religious leaders, scribes and Pharisees, hypocrites, Jesus calls them, would go as far as on their mint and cumin and anise to go as far as to count the tiny little minuscule seeds and the tiny little leaves of these plants that were simply grown for household spices, personal use, and they would tithe upon those things that minuscule, things that were not actually income, and they were just simple seasonings for meals. But yet, on the surface, that sounds good, right? Wow, that's pretty good. Just paying close attention to detail, you know, tithe on what needs to be tithe. By the way, we can all learn from that, if you will. But no, really, on the surface, that's great. But the truth of the matter is, it wasn't something honorable. It was nothing. It wasn't something that Jesus would see as above and beyond and being generous. But he points out it's that precision of something very trivial. I mean, they had to get it right, something that trivial, and then total neglect of the important things that mattered. That's the point there, okay? They were consumed with these minor do's and don'ts, but they were very lax and indifferent on things related to character and ethics, things like judgment, mercy, and faith that Jesus mentioned there, conditions of the heart. Jesus calls them, refers to them as the weightier matters, the more significant matters, okay? By calling them weightier matters, he's actually borrowed a word from the writings of those rabbis. They use that term. They had literally, in their traditions, divided the law up in two categories: heavy things and light things. So there were lighter issues in their eyes and weightier issues in their eyes, and that's where Jesus gets that term. He uses that term. If he got it from them or not, I don't know. But in their warped way of setting their spiritual priorities, they would throw the more minuscule, small do's and don'ts, they would throw that into the category of weightier, more important things, and then consider the things of the heart, the things that God really sees and makes a difference to him, that whether we have it or not, they'd throw them in the category of lighter things. And it's hard to imagine that they could not see that those kind of inverted priorities were unacceptable to God. I mean, they were living upside down, so to speak. And but such was the character of their legalistic practices, okay? Such was the nature of their self-righteousness. Think about it. Things like tithing, very biblical, okay? But those are things that they're boxes you can check. Either you tithe or you didn't tithe, right? It's you can check the box or not check the box, accomplished or not accomplished, done or not done, okay? They are measurable by human terms, okay? Heart issues like love and faith and compassion and kindness and patience, these things can't be measured precisely, right? You can't just check a box on that. There's no human gauge that can regulate those things where we can check a box or not check a box. And so that's why it wasn't important to them, because they wanted something measurable. They wanted something that technical, that could be a measure of their behavior, so they'd have a better spiritual resume. But when you're dealing with the conditions of the heart, only you and God know what's going on there, right? Can't put it on your resume, because nobody knows whether it's credible or not. So they were more concerned about their self-righteous accomplishments than they were about any kind of character of the heart that would make a difference in the eyes of God. They would do all of this that we're talking about here under the guise of serving God. They thought they were doing it the way God wanted to, and they were so far off base. The truth of the matter is, they were doing it all to be seen of men. It was pretentious. It was hypocritical. And it was their way of life. And Jesus goes on in verse 24, and I'm done. He says, "Ye blind guides, which strain at a gnat and swallow a camel." Now, very apparent what he's meaning there, but there's something that I read that I'd never read before, that a gnat and a camel are obviously two extremes, but bear with me just a moment, it's coming. Here it is. Unclean. The unclean animals, the things that God listed in the scripture as unclean and not, the gnat is the smallest and the camel is the largest. That's what I read. I didn't follow through and look all that up, but that's what John MacArthur said. So it's kind of neat. But it, in principle, it's right there whether that's accurate or not. They could accept arrogance, pride, condescending attitudes. That, in fact, they had those things. They could accept that, no big deal. And then some little minuscule box that didn't get checked, they would hold somebody to the fire on it, and it was a big deal. And so it's even said that I read that they would, as far as the analogy goes, they would drink their wine with clenched teeth because wine attracted tiny insects, gnats, and they would drink their wine with clenched teeth to make sure they strained any gnats out of it, okay? So there's another bonus for you, okay? but anyway, so Jesus, that analogy there, strain at a gnat and swallow a camel, man, they could tolerate the poorest, most bitter-hearted Pharisaical people around them. I mean, they were just godly, and then some person that couldn't check the boxes, they thought little of. So it's just crazy. So we'll look further. I'm beginning to think that Jesus has them nailed, you know. He's pretty much covering everything. And so next time we're together, we'll take a look at what's next, okay? Let's go ahead and stand. Appreciate you guys very much. We'll go ahead and dismiss in a word of prayer, and we'll look forward to seeing you guys back here Sunday. Stay warm and be safe. And JP, will you lead us in prayer, please?